The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on June 14, 2009. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Well, about a month ago at one of Norm's Wednesday night discussion groups, little side discussion we had briefly, the idea that don't all religions teach the same thing? Aren't they really about the same thing? I question that, and then there was a little bit of a discussion there. But I didn't really have time to say what I thought about all of that. And I don't really have that much time today either. But I thought I would like to say a little bit more than I could have said that evening. Even though most of you weren't there, but still, an interesting point. And it could easily get us caught up in a lot of discussion, I think. But don't all religions teach the same thing, basically? They bring us to the same point. Well, I question this a bit. I mean, here we talk a lot about no separation. And it was observed that, well, doesn't Christianity teach that there's no separation between us and God? Well, yeah, maybe some forms of Christianity. There's other forms like Calvinism that, you know, talk about how the only thing that keeps you from hell is just God's grace. I mean, you're so unworthy of God's grace that you're just lucky you're not roasting right now. And so there's all kinds of forms of Christianity, and Buddhism too, for that matter. And then this did seem to get into a bit of a discussion about Christianity and Buddhism. But I wasn't defending Buddhism or pitting that against Christianity. But this question, do all religions teach the same thing? Well, yes and no, I suppose. If we look at the word religion, something I've mentioned many times here before, it comes from the term religio. In Latin, it means to rebind or to reunite. Well, with what? Well, of course, we could say God or truth or reality. We could put many things there, Dharma. And if that is what religion is about, then, yeah, I would say, yeah, then they all teach the same thing. And I think that is what religion really, in the end, is about. The problem is that we're human beings and we think. We create ideas. We create beliefs. We have different kinds of stories and opinions and theories and concepts. And we are invariably captivated by these things, taken away by these things, you know, captured, occupied. But this matter of truth, or God, or reality, think of God perhaps what is ultimate truth, reality. Whatever that is, that very essential thing. Isn't religion about bringing us to that? Well, in a sense, I would say so. But then it's in the ways that this gets handled that we run into trouble. And so what I'd like to do is to look at just Christianity and Buddhism for a little bit here. Put it into kind of a historical context in regards to one issue that is central to each of these religions. And then just let's see where we are after that. Well, in Christianity, we have the notion that God is good. God is all-powerful. Well, let's see if we can trace this idea. Where did this come from? When the Indo-Aryan people came down from the central steppes of Asia thousands of years ago, they eventually split into two, and the Aryan people went into what later became Persia. And eventually, a fellow by the name of Zoroaster appeared in that culture. And just to give a little context here, he was very given to the religious life. He trained in it early on. He was very precocious in that way, as far as we can tell. But he was very concerned with the fighting that was going on in the culture. There were many people who believed in certain kinds of gods, and they seemed to be, rabble-rousers, causing a lot of trouble. And turns out these gods, the devas, eventually that term came out of Zoroaster, it becomes our term devil. But those people were troublemakers, and they worshipped those kinds of gods, the devas. But there were also the Asuras, or the Ahuras, as they called them. And so Zoroaster taught that these were the good gods, and very quickly, basically, what he introduced into the world was the idea of good and evil, in the sense, not that that idea wasn't around before, but in the sense that the human drama, the human stage here, where everything is unfolding and taking place, is this fight, this battle between good and evil. And good was represented by Ahura Mazda, the great Ahura god. I always forget the other guy on the other side. He goes by a couple of names, and I can never remember him at this critical moment when I'm in front of people talking. It might come to me, right on the edge of it. But the bad guy, the embodiment, the epitome of evil. And it's going to be this battle that goes on between good and evil, battle to the death. Eventually, the good will win out, but what you have to do, what we have to do as human beings, we need to choose. We need to choose sides. And who are we going to battle with and for? And if we don't choose the side of good, well, ultimately we will be defeated. Well, anyway, this became a very strong and a very graspable kind of idea. This sort of idea was not in any of the world's religions before that time. And Zoroaster, now, he was coming along. The dates are pretty obscure, but most people would put them probably about 1200 BCE. And it was shortly after this time that we find the Hebrew people were beginning to form an identity. They would have stories that would take this identity back several centuries before that, but we don't really have any true record of this up until about 1000 BCE or so. But these people, they had a notion of God. Their God was, their main God was kind of nasty and jealous and vindictive and cruel, perhaps we could even say, in many cases. Anyway, that's kind of the idea that they had. And eventually, these people were really torn apart and they were right at the crossroads of where all kinds of civilizations were occurring and crossing through and passing through. They were in a very bad spot in that regard to try to hold themselves together as a small band of people. And eventually, many things go on in the history, but eventually they're hauled off to Babylon, in the Babylonian Empire of those days. And they spent about, 40 or more years there in exile. And during this time, they picked up some of these notions, because you see, the Persian or the Babylonians and the Persian, they took on these teachings of Zoroaster. They were Zoroastrians, and this notion then of good pitted against evil started creeping in, and this idea that there would be this Saushant, this Messiah, this one who would be born, who would lead the people to victory, and this sort of thing. Well, this also was embedded in Zoroastrian kind of teachings. And eventually the children of Israel, they picked this up. They got these ideas. But they still had many troubled times. This is around 400 BCE now or so. And eventually these notions then of good and evil, forces of good, forces of evil, really started becoming kind of embedded in a lot of their teachings and discussions. And eventually by the time we get to Christianity, we have many different people going out and espousing various kinds of beliefs in regards to all of this, including Jesus, who then picks this up, and he's with the millennials. He thought that this was going to be the end of the world any day now, and that the Son of Man would come riding in on the clouds, and the Messiah, the Saushant, the one who the Savior of all, and they would be victorious and set up their kingdom here on earth that would last for a millennia. This is all Zoroastrian kind of ideas. But the God of Jesus was quite a different God. Of course, he's talking about this heaven on earth kind of situation, where God now is very good and kind and benevolent and given to justice and not to cruelty and that sort of thing. Well, then as Christianity continues to evolve after the Roman Emperor Constantine and then becomes very powerful as the Roman Empire dies out in Western Europe at least, and Christianity was carried on after the fall of Rome. And now we have these ideas that, yes, well, God is good, but also God is all-powerful. These early gods too, by the way, including the God of the Hebrew children, he was not an all-powerful God, but he was just the first among others. But now the Christians had the idea that this is one and only true God, and he's good, and he's all-powerful, and all-knowing. And then we have all kinds of endless debates that have gone on from about the High Middle Ages on, or even before, actually. Arguments by Thomas Aquinas and Anselm and many others who would argue, trying to make a case for the fact that there can be this one, this all-powerful, all-knowing and kind and good and just God. And these debates have gone on ever since, I mean, up till today, and they still go on. And nobody even seems to recognize, well, some do, but they can't finally defeat it, that you can't have something that is all-powerful and all-knowing and all-good. And who created this world? It's just, you can't get all these things together. Problem is, every time one of the people who would argue this, the anti-theists, maybe we could say, I don't want to just say the atheists, but they would argue against this, but they can never kill that one off. And somehow the theists are able to come back. And so we end up with this kind of unresolved, endless debate. And it goes on today. Well, this is a problem. And I would say this is one of Christianity's biggest problems. So how can you have anything such as that? And consider where it came from, where these notions came from. They're just from people struggling, trying to make sense of the world. They didn't know a lot about what was going on, but it evolves in various ways, and here we're left with this conundrum here that really doesn't make any sense if you look at it very carefully, and we can't make any sense of it. Okay, that's kind of a general look at that particular problem in Christianity. I'll look at a problem in Buddhism, and this is the idea, the notion of reincarnation. Let's take a look at how this began to develop. Here we have that Indo-Aryan group, the ones that branched eastward and went into India. They encountered a civilization, I call them Maluan because of the ancient Sumerians. Now they refer to these people as Maluan, though Harappan is the name of the culture. I don't know why they picked that name. It's the name of one of the cities of these people. But this was a great civilization that was there in the Indus Valley. The largest, actually, of all ancient civilizations, though we don't know anything about it up until about 100 years ago or so. But this huge civilization, and this civilization was dying out when the Indo-Aryans were coming in. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of warfare or anything that took place, but there was this incredible mixing of ideas of religious beliefs and gods and whatever else that eventually evolved into Hinduism, a very rich and imaginative religion. Though very strange and impossible to understand. Spent a whole lifetime looking at it, and I still don't understand it. Though I know a few things about it. But they traced their teachings back. The earliest teachings that they had were the Vedas, and some people say that these go back to 2300 BCE or whatever. But if you look at the Vedas themselves, you get the impression that, and some people think, that they might go back 30,000 years. Well, of course, there was no writing then. Of course, the Vedas themselves weren't written down until about maybe 1200 BCE or so. It was an oral tradition. But they would have stories talking about when the earth was covered with ice and things like this. And it was, what, the age of glaciers, whatever? Some people think so. It's hard to know. Basically, what this was, and this was sort of the teachings of these people, and they were mainly focused on religious ritual, just doing the right things for the gods and performing the rituals properly so that the gods would then give favors to them and that sort of thing. And this was their main concern. And in their teachings, they talk a lot about good crops and long life and children and, you know, many children and this sort of thing. Just basically the good life that any one of us probably could relate to. You know, long life, healthy life, good crops, you know, food, shelter, children, sure. That all sounds very good. And this was primarily their concern up until about maybe 1200 BCE or so. Things began to change. Actually, about that time, they then moved into the Ganges Valley there, and then they began to settle. These Aryan people, the Indus civilization had long ago vanished at this point, and they settled in this region. And now, as farmers and that sort of thing, they didn't have to struggle quite so much. They became more prosperous, and they didn't have to struggle quite so much for their living and survival as they once did. Just like with us today, we live in such plenty that it sometimes it might be hard for us to think that there's really something to all these things. I mean, and with all the stuff that we have, there's a tendency in some of us, at least we feel it very strongly, that, well, is this all there is? Is this all there is to human life, just to have stuff and to, you know, be entertained? And isn't there something more to human life than all of this? We might end up with kind of a vacant or vacuous kind of feeling in our heart. This sort of thing occurred to these people living in the Ganges plain there at that time. They were getting more prosperous, so they began to look at all the stuff that their religion had promised them. Well, I mean, abundant crops and children, long life, happiness, and all that. Isn't there something more to this? And new kinds of teachings then. By this time, the Vedas were written down, but now new kinds of teachings were being written, and these became the Upanishads. Started developing around, mostly they developed probably from about 800 BC to about 400 BCE. But what was happening here was that people were beginning to question all of this. Like, for example, there's a story of a fellow, a Brahmin by the name of Nachiketas, and he once was accidentally snubbed, you might say, by Yama, the god of death. And when Yama realized what he had done, you don't snub a Brahmin, you know, so to make up, he gave him three wishes. And I can't remember what the first two were, but his third wish was he wanted to know what happens to one after you die. And Yama said, oh, don't ask me that one. He said, I can't give that to you. Even the gods did not know. Nachiketas noticed, yes, that's true, the gods, they've never written down in all their ancient teachings and writings any explanation for what happens. It's like this is great mystery. But here's Yama, the god, who else would know about the god of death? But he didn't want to tell him. And so he promises him, and I said, well, I'll give you children and long life and prosperity and this sort of thing. He starts listing all these things that the people who had followed this way for as far as they knew, thousands of years. And he said, well, what does this all mean when all of this? He said, it's just temporary. It is all taken away with you, Yama. You come, you end of all, he calls him. You come and you take all this away. What does it even mean that we get these things? So there was this beginning now of really questioning things very deeply that was occurring in this particular religion or time and place. Before, they weren't really concerned so much with death. I mean, you have family, it goes on, and that sort of thing. But now it was getting to be kind of personal. And the concern for self was beginning to appear, and a lot of discussion about self. And pretty soon you had writings and teachings like, well, you know, just as a caterpillar gets to the end of a stalk of grass and then reaches out and takes hold of another stalk of grass and then leaves the first and goes on to the next, so it is that we will leave this body and we reemerge into another life. This kind of idea, and it was expressed in a number of different ways, poetic and kind of imaginative ways like this. Rudimentary notions of the idea of reincarnation, then, to satisfy this sense of what happens to us after we die. But then he was just talking about, well, so we leave here and then we go, and where do we go? Well, maybe then we go up and we live with the gods and the ancestors. They had a kind of a three-tiered universe. There was the heavens up here and earth down here, and then there's kind of this mid-space, but you would somehow go up there as the incense smoke. They would burn the incense smoke over the funeral pyres, and as the smoke would go up, You would go up there to live with them. And then what? The question began. Well, you would be there until, once again, you would die. And this notion of re-death, and that was the word that they used, re-death, you would die again. Into what? And this became a very troubling kind of question for them. But the idea was that originally you would just die once you go up there and into a better situation, and that's it. But you could die again. And there was nothing to guarantee that you wouldn't. And that struck people as being just as disturbing. We haven't really gotten anywhere with this. But then the idea that which you could die again, repeat. And as the Upanishads developed and times went on, you started finding different kinds of teachings then that began to express this dying again and again and again, being reborn again and again, but not always necessarily going upward into a higher realm. You could come back as an animal or a plant or an insect. So this is the notion of reincarnation that developed. And these kinds of teachings were taught north of the Gangetic Plain. They're up in the foothills of the Himalayas. But eventually this really spread. It really caught on among the populace. It became deeply ingrained probably by 800 BCE. It was really widely taught. And by the time, some centuries later, Pythagoras, a Greek, came wandering through that area. He picked up this notion, eventually brought it back to Greece, where it was enjoyed and believed and preached and taught among some of the higher-ranked people, the educated ones. But it never caught on among the masses. But here in India, it did. And it completely saturated all the thinking there in the culture. And this occupation with the self, and where does it go after it dies? And now this is where we were at the time of the Buddha. So then the Buddha comes along, and he teaches that we don't find this self here. And he points out the way that if we look very carefully at our experience, we realize that this thing that we're concerned about, that where does it go after death, this sort of thing, is an illusory thing, that we don't really find it within our experience. Well, that's a very difficult thing for people to understand. People then would go on, they would interpret his teaching, the Anatta doctrine, that we don't find self within this experience in various ways. And they would take this idea, began to modify it in all kinds of ways, and then even have discussions and debates about it. Well, if we don't find the self there, well, then what is it that transmigrates? What is it that is reborn? Because don't we still have this teaching of reincarnation that was so deeply ingrained in the people, they wouldn't abandon that kind of idea. And so these kinds of debates and discussion have gone on since, and they're still prevalent in Buddhism today among many people who believe in reincarnation. And how do we make that compatible then with this teaching that we don't find self? And of course, it is very difficult, and they can't quite answer that. And no matter how the debates go, we never arrive at any kind of satisfactory answer. Just like in Christianity, no matter where we go, how do we end up having this entity here that is all good, all knowing, all powerful, and created this world here, knowing ahead of time that millions of human beings would be condemned to everlasting torment? Doesn't make sense. Same thing with this teaching of reincarnation. There's an idea here that just doesn't make sense, particularly in view of what the Buddha pointed to, saying that this is great liberation to be found in this. Well, so here we are then today. In Buddhism, we find this huge problem, one of many, but there's a huge problem here that cannot be resolved or made any sense of. Same thing in Christianity, one of many. There's many others I could point out, but these are two big ones on each side. And this is a problem for these religions, and they haven't been resolved. That's what I want to look at now then. This question then comes up, don't all religions teach the same thing? Aren't all religions about getting to the truth, waking up to the truth, whether we call that God or Dharma or whatever we want, finally not being fooled and deceived and troubled and disturbed? Isn't this what religion is about? I would say yes, I think that is what religion is about. But how is it then that we keep running off into these areas where we get into all kinds of trouble with but wherever you go, we run into. How is it that we run into trouble? How is it that we run into disagreement? How is it that we run into something to fight and argue about and debate about? The philosophical, theological discussions and debates that go on. The endless debates that go on also in Buddhist. And the endless debates of the great scholars and thinkers and writers of the Upanishads. And they really did look deeply into this human problem. In the end, what is this all about anyway? Never finding any resolution to this. But isn't religion this deep desire finally at long last to resolve this problem? Yeah, I think it is. Where's the problem with this? And don't all religions teach this? See, and that's where I differed with that point that was made, that all religions then basically teach the same thing. Well, maybe they do. They want to, they intend to, but they don't. And why don't they? That's because we grasp, we believe, we form ideas and theories, and we discuss these things and debate endlessly, all the while ignoring actual human experience right here. And I would say this is what the Buddha pointed out to us so long ago in very clear terms. There may be some Christian mystics who have done the same. I don't know, but that could very well be the case. But this was certainly made very clear in the teachings of the Buddha. However, and this is a quote I had heard, I tapped Linda yesterday because she knows a lot about Krishnamurti. I had to get this quote final. Did Krishnamurti really say this? J. Krishnamurti, he said, "Nobody listened to Buddha. That's why we have Buddhism." And I think that's really true. People didn't listen to Buddha. What Krishnamurti, when I read that discussion, Krishnamurti is not easy to follow, but you know, sometimes I get. But it seemed like what he was saying, that not really hearing what it was, because we come with our own agendas, we come with our theories, our ideas. We've already got our program. And out of that program that we have, we have ideas and notions and questions that we think need to be addressed and answered. We don't pay any attention to the fact that these are flat earth questions. You know how I use that term, right? I've talked about that enough. Flat earth questions formed out of the total misreading and misunderstanding of what's being experienced here. And so then we come to a teacher like that, what it was that the Buddha pointed out. And of course we can't grasp as an idea, a notion, one more thing now to believe in. When we do attempt to grasp it, as people have done, then we think that the Buddha taught that there is no self. Well, the Buddha did not teach that there is no self. That would be a graspable. It is still tied in with the notion that there could be such a thing as a self. What the Buddha pointed out is we don't find such a thing within actual experience. But this can't be grasped. This can't be held as a belief. And this is what religion is about in the end. And belief, the fact that as human beings we do believe things, we embrace ideas and notions and hold them as though they were true. We subscribe to them and fight to the death over them in many instances. In working in this way, we somehow try to work our way, fight our way, grovel our way to the truth. How many of us recognize what we're doing as we're doing that? That clearly this is not the way to the truth. Another quote of Krishnamurti where he said, "Truth is a trackless land. There is no way to the truth. No tracks in that land. Truth is right here. This is it here. This is reality here. We awaken to it here." This is what the Buddha pointed out. And there may be some mystics. I don't know of any because of what mystical readings I have read. There's still this talk of, no separation, reunion with God. And of course, that's the idea of religio too, to reunite. But the Buddha's insight was such as we realize that there isn't any separation in the first place. But that's a misunderstanding, a misreading of what our actual experience is. And that's what the true religious experience is finally to realize that, to know that, to see that, and to stop thinking about it or arguing for it. Because anything you would argue for or what you're setting up now you're going to try to move that through. And don't you recognize what that is? That is not truth. That is human suffering and confusion and anger. So this is a completely different way. This somehow has to be brought across, because this is what it is that the Buddha was pointing out. And there may have been others, but this is what the Buddha, in the end, was pointing out. But we will take it, as my teacher used to say, Katagiri Roshi, he would say that we make it into Buddhism. Buddhism is just one of the isms. So we have Buddhist beliefs, reincarnation, this, that, one thing or another. Just one of the isms. Now we can sit down there and fight with other people. If this is what we're doing, and I would, I'll call it, that's Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Because what I said the other night there too is that I'm not out to promote Buddhism. And I don't consider myself Buddhist. This isn't about promoting or holding to an identity or taking some kind of packaged idea, belief, concept, and to sell it. What the Buddha taught was a way for us to open our eyes and to see directly, without saying a word, without thinking a word, without grasping a word. This is what it was that the Buddha pointed out. So the kind of teachings in it that have followed have caused endless trouble, endless problems, just as we find in the Christian world, in the human world, across the human world. Because it is it's not really difficult, but it is so subtle that we just continue to miss it, what it was that the Buddha was pointing out. Like, for example, how this might manifest. This understanding. We could think that religions all want peace. Islam means peace, I think, something like that. Or it means submission, but I think somehow the word peace is in there. In Christianity, we talk about the Prince of Peace, Jesus, the Prince of Peace. In Buddhism, we talk about the pacified mind, the settled mind. It's peaceful. So we find this kind of idea or notion. But the moment we grasp it, with an idea, this is something we need to promote and to bring to people, we don't recognize what we're doing. And religion is about, what it was, this freedom, this liberation that the Buddha spoke of, is see what you're doing. It's not about holding an idea or promoting an idea. If you just see what is here, you recognize what peace is, and peace is to stop. Because if you don't stir things up, you don't try to sell something or bring it through, or even though you think this is a wonderful and good thing, and we must bring it to others, if you don't go about this in the right way, all you're going to do is to create what is not peace. In fact, that's all we can do, is create the opposite of peace, whatever that might be. It could be any number of things. We can't create peace. We don't need to create peace. We need to see it. We need to recognize it. And that peace is in wholeness. It is in totality. It is waking up to that and to realize it fundamentally, ultimately, from the beginning, so to speak. There I've made a division, but there's no separation. This is it right here. Peace isn't something then that we carry to other people, or we try to put upon other people, or to teach them peaceful ways and things like that. It simply doesn't work in that way. It would be nice. We're eager. We want to get out there and do something. But we don't recognize that this is just a continuous perpetuation of the problem that we all suffer from as human beings, that we're confused. So if we want to finally understand what it was that the Buddha pointed, this is very difficult for me to help you see this. Because in the end, it isn't really handing you something. Here, take this, do this. Believe this, grasp this idea. It is about recognizing finally what happens when we do that, and also recognizing the subtlety with which all of that takes place. The immediacy of it. How quick we are to grasp and to try to bring it through. So this is what I would say that religion then in the end is about. And then wouldn't all religion, yeah, because there's only one way, this is it. And I wouldn't call it Buddhism. I wouldn't call it Christianity or Islam or Taoism or Hinduism. I wouldn't call it anything. Well, we do say Buddha Dharma. This is what the awakened teach. Buddha Dharma. That's what that means. Buddha awakened Dharma teaching. For those then who are awake, and I don't care if it's a Christian mystic or whatever, but I would say if you're still holding to some identity, even as Christian or Muslim or Buddhist, anything, you're still in a divided world, and you're still talking about reuniting with something here. It's not seeing right from the very start that there's no division in the first place. How can you take on an identity then as something, Buddhist or anything else? So this is what this teaching, and it isn't different kinds. It isn't Buddhist or Muslim or Hindu or Christian. It is just what it is. It's just this. It's just this one way. There's this one way that is peace. There is this one way that is understanding. There is this one way that is compassion. There is this one way that is liberation, that is wisdom. And either we see that or we do not. You can't drag this around and try to sell it to people. It's a matter for each one of us to, and by the way, morality resides with you. It's just not something that we can preach or legislate or force on people. It comes from just seeing and recognizing just what this is. So that's what this way is. That's what this teaching is. It's very subtle. It's difficult. Because so quickly, once again, we're going to take hold of it in some fashion or another and run with it. And it's almost impossible not to do that. That's why we have to learn to bring ourselves back moment by moment. Very quickly, very easily, we get caught in something or other. And our way is just to bring, just let that go now and just come back. Here's where you're going to find peace and understanding and wisdom and compassion and all of that. So that's what this way is. Doesn't mean that we sit then quietly forever on our zafus. No, we're in the world, we're human beings, we have to get up, we need to go to work, we need to raise some food. We have to take care of our daily life. And while doing that, easily, interacting with other people, we're caught. But our way, and there's only this one way to peace and understanding, to truth, to whatever it is that religion promises, this to reunite, to just come here and be here with truth. And it isn't from some quarter. It's from all quarters, if it's from one. And it doesn't belong to anybody or to any religion. And it is just this. And this is what we need to wake up to. This is what we need to see. And maybe just get a glimmer. Next thing you know, we're caught again. But we can remind ourselves, to bring ourselves back, till finally we learn to just stop, not to get too carried away. We take care of the things we need to take care of for the moment, and maybe looking ahead, but we don't latch on to any of that, insist that it must be so or must go this way. We just bring ourselves back to this to recognize whether we're becoming insane once again. I talked about that last time I spoke here. So this is insurance, I guess, maybe against our insanity. And I don't care what it is that you're clinging to, what your cause is, what your belief is, what your noble goal is. You grasp it, and it is war, it is fighting, it is insanity, it is pain, suffering. You want to teach peace, and you just have to point to what peace is. There's nothing to do about it. Peace is already here. All we can do is disturb it. Okay, well, maybe I've said enough about this morning, but do you have any questions? Yeah, Jay.
During your talk, I was thinking about Joseph Campbell, what he said about religion, the problem with religion is that it gets in the way of spirituality. And I started to think about that a little more in detail, in the sense that what I was thinking, of, what he probably was trying to tell us, that the power of myth and stories is we don't latch on this truth, but even when we start looking at the stories, and then we start overlaying so much that we're doing the same thing back again, but I think he was actually trying to get us to open up to the possibilities and not have a frozen view. So it was an effective way, but I expect even there we do the same thing.
Yeah, well, as Dolman said, there's traps and snares everywhere, and we have to also begin to develop a sense of just how easily we are entrapped and snared. Yeah. It's one way to tell a story when you know it's a story. Now it can have great function, great value for us. It's a story, and the truth of it is ungraspable, but you can learn to recognize that truth in your life as you're living it. That's its value. The moment you grasp it in any kind of literal way at all, that this story actually happened, we have to understand that all cases of that is delusion. Even the story you'll tell yourself now of how you got here this morning is delusional. If you think that what it is that you're telling yourself about how you got here, you're explaining to someone else as if this were the truth, we have to recognize this is never the truth. But in fiction, when we know right up front that this is fiction, this was never pretended to be a true story, now we have a chance to point out something very valuable about human life that cannot be pointed to if there's some intention there to grasp something about this, as if it were true. Truth is a trackless land. Truth isn't something like that that's situated off from other things. But this can be learned and discovered, like through mythology, if we take this properly. Now, it could be that people who invented the different myths and stories from times back, that they had beliefs in these sorts of things. But actually, the studies that I've done in this area, I think if that happened at all, I think it happened far less than we think it did, or that we would even take the story ourselves today. Ancient people, Paleolithic people, as far as we can tell, they didn't grasp any of this as if it were a truth, but I think they used it in a very powerful way that says a lot about human psychology and human life and all of that. So that's what we need to be looking at. And also just watching our own grasping mind and realize you're going to kill it. You think that you're getting hold of something that way, but actually you're killing it and you're confusing yourself. You know, so if we take the myth properly, a myth can be very helpful and very powerful. But the moment you think the myth is true, you know, then we've got a problem. It's like, I'd love to go through the Vimalakirti Sutra again here. Like I said, the last time, it was right about the time we were forming Dharma Field, it took about 3 years to get through it, so I'm reluctant to do that again. And I don't know if I want to just tell you to go read it either, because the stories that are in there are so fantastic. And if you grasp them, or in any way take them in some literal sense, you're going to miss it entirely. Power is in realizing this is all mythology right from the very start, and don't grasp any of it, but what it points to about what we are as human beings and how we are and our grasping and our getting caught up in dualism, all of this is powerful. But we have to see it as mythology, as not literally true. Now we have a chance of waking up, because the waking up is in the not grasping, is in just the seeing. But we quickly will interpret that, then this means something else. We'll put a word on it, a phrase, and we take it away. And now we're caught over here, all the while missing the rich, vibrant reality that is our life. We do this endlessly, and it is very subtle. Yes, Fiona.
When you talk about belonging to a lineage, and so my question is, how do you experience your lineage without falling into any of the traps that you've discussed this morning relative to Buddhism or Christianity?
Well, I never think about that. I mean, I'm aware of that. I have deep appreciation for all the teachers that have gone on before. You know, their names on a list. I can recite the list. You know, ostensibly it goes back to Buddha. I don't think so, but I'm sure it goes through Dogen, probably all the way back to Huineng, but these are just names. We can talk about Shakespeare and Beethoven, and in our minds they become something real. Well, what is Shakespeare and what is Beethoven? We can have a deep appreciation of that glorious music, that wonderful music, those incredible plays that reveal so much about human life, and what a mind to write something like this. But we experience that here in this moment, and we can have deep appreciation for the fact that there were people who created these kinds of things for us. And so we can have a deep appreciation. Then we see that storyline, yeah, okay, and we see it for what it is. But exactly what, and who were these people? I don't know. For that matter, who are you? For that matter, who am I? We don't even have to grasp that. So we can live with the richness of all of this and the tradition and the ways that things have come to us with just a grateful heart, deep appreciation. And beyond that, I don't know what more can be done. Because the moment we say, well, yeah, this was, you know, we make somebody concrete and real and graspable as if somehow, now I know them. Yeah, I know it, yeah. And we're totally lost in delusion and we don't know it. So I never think about it that way. I never try to grasp the lineage. But I have deep appreciation for whoever these beings were. You know, in that sense, the past isn't even real. They're here now. So I'm very grateful for this moment where I can read some of these profound teachings. I can listen to Beethoven, watch a Shakespeare play. It's all wonderful. I even appreciate all the horrendous things that human beings have done as well, in the sense that they also can provide us a great understanding of what we can do, how we can get ourselves into trouble. So we can even appreciate that. But I wouldn't want to try to emulate things of that sort. And in the case of the music of Beethoven, I couldn't. Darn. I wish I could. I used to want to be a composer when I was a young person. So I don't know if that answered your question or not. But no, you know, it's not a... I mean, I don't even know what that means, a belief in Dogen. What does that even mean? Are these writings... Yes, but even when we say expounding his teachings, I don't know. I mean, language forces us into that, but... In the moment, I draw my attention back to that. Well, I don't know what his refers to. I mean, well, refers to Dogen. Yeah, I understand that. Okay, what does Dogen refer to? I don't know. I mean, what's a human? Yeah, I understand that. And human beings gave us these writings. Yeah, I understand that. We have these writings. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. But do we have to grasp any of that? And in thinking, well, I know Dogen. But there is this teaching here, and it's incredible. Some of it. Some of Dogen kind of turns me off, but I have to look at that too. So we can do all of this without grasping. And what our way is to recognize when we are grasping and what that is. And that is the formation of self. That's a sense of separation. And now we can interpret religion then as, oh, then I have to somehow reunite myself with God or the truth or something like that. Well, you know, but this is all coming out of a misunderstanding. A not paying attention to what's actually unfolding here. And that's our liberation. There's our freedom. That's a unification with truth. It's a recognition that there was no separation to begin with. And here's Dogen, Beethoven, all of it. You know, Hitler, too. It's all there. So, and then, of course, we can say, oh, okay, so Beethoven, Dogen, they were pretty good guys. Hitler, now he's kind of on the bad side of the, you know. Well, there we go again. Watch what you're doing. Anything else? Well, it is 11 o'clock, I guess. Ooh, well, one more. Okay, Nancy.
Is this part of why you wanted us to stop doing the for yourself about?
No, I can't really tell you why. Again, I'm not trying to be vague or anything. But, I'm just trying my best to help people wake up. That's all. And at some point, the thing about singing the four vows, I don't know. But why did I decide, and why did I decide just at that moment and when and all these, I don't know. This is something that's kind of gone back and forth at different times when I've thought of it. But if you want me to give you a concrete, specific reason why, you know, I can't. But I can say this, the backdrop of where I am with all of this is really I just want to help people wake up, that's all. And I make mistakes. Maybe that's not such a good idea to drop the four vows. But reminding us of that, you don't, you won't, yeah. So that's probably a very inadequate answer. I'm sorry, but I really don't have any real reason. But I don't even have any reason to sit meditation either. So, but I do. Okay, maybe that's it. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.